Meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Monday, April 29th. It is 3:20 p.m. Before we begin, I'd like to introduce my committee aide, Deneen Tuck, and thank Sophia Tenney, our current House Labor and Commerce Secretary, and Doug Bridges, our LIO moderator. This time, I'd like to remind everybody to silence their cell phones. Present today are Representative Hannon, Representative Rivak, Representative Tallarico, Representative Stutz, Co-Chair Wong, and myself, Co-Chair Ledoux. We have a quorum to conduct business today. We have several items on the agenda. Our first item is HB 97, Telehealth Physician Assistance Drugs. This is our first hearing on House Bill 97. And it looks like we have a committee substitute to adopt. Representative Wong, can I have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move that the Labor and Commerce Committee adopt the committee substitute for HB 97 Work Order 31LS0695/S as a working document.
There being no objection, version S is adopted as the working document. I see that Reed Harris, legislative aide to Representative Christ Tompkins, is here to present the bill now in its CS form. Reed, would you please join us at the table, introduce yourself for the record, and explain the bill, including the CS.
Madam Speaker, before could you tell me which committee version S is? Because I have Health and Social Services U in my packet.
That's what I have.
So what committee is S?
House Labor and Commerce Committee.
Madam Chair, through the chair, I could introduce her.
Okay, good.
Here it is.
Okay, so we go.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Reed Harris. I'm staff to Representative Christ Tompkins. Representative Hannon through the chair. U is the most recent version that was adopted in the HES committee. Version S is now the Labor and Commerce CS, which the committee just adopted. For the record.
Thank you. You can proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 97 increases patient access to care, particularly for rural and medically underserved areas. This is a companion bill to Senate Bill 44, sponsored by Senator Giesel, and thank you for adopting the CS. Version S now brings this bill in alignment with the most recent version that Senate Finance passed out. So the Senate companion is sitting on the floor over there. This is a cleanup bill from 2016, the Medicaid Reform Act, which was Senate Bill 74. SB 74 revised statute to allow physicians to render a diagnosis, provide treatment, prescribe, dispense, or administer prescription drugs to a person without prior without conducting a physical examination prior to taking care of the patient. This was the basis for the creation of telemedicine in the state of Alaska. There have been various bills that have floated around in committees for a couple of years, but SB 74 is what finally made it happen. In response to SB 74, the State Medical Board created new guidelines for physicians, but these were not applied to physicians' assistants. They were excluded because they weren't specifically named in the bill, and the State Medical Board, with an abundance of caution, essentially said that, okay, physicians can now practice telemedicine. Physicians' assistants may not. However, the legislative intent, I spoke with the original sponsor of the bill along with one of their staffers, who is now Representative Kopp in this body, was that physicians' assistants would be able to practice telemedicine. The board, however, basically said no. So this bill essentially adds physicians' assistants into statute everywhere where it lists physicians as far as being able to practice telemedicine. A physician's assistant, if I could turn the committee's attention to the document labeled AAPA document, that's the American Association of Physician's Assistants. That lays out their scope of practice right there, but I can just briefly summarize it and save the committee the reading time if you would care. Thank you, ma'am. A physician's assistant is a clinician that can take medical histories, perform physical examinations, do lab testing, diagnosis, create treatment plans, and prescribe medications and assist in surgery. PAs undergo extensive medical training with 27 months of classroom instruction, rotations in both medical and surgical disciplines, 2,000 hours of supervised clinical practice, and furthermore, most PA programs are master's degrees or all will be by 2020. The state medical board guidelines for what physician's assistants can do in your outlined in your packet under scope of practice by the state medical board. Physician's assistants must have an active collaborative plan with a physician. This requires physician oversight. Specifically, if you'd allow me to find the correct document here, excuse me. There you go. The physician must have a method of quality insurance that includes regular contact with the PA, both via telephone or radio, and mind you, sometimes these people are working in extremely remote areas, and in-person contacts as well. State law requires, at a minimum, monthly telephone or radio contact and at least 2 days each quarter of direct and personal contact for the purpose of reviewing the physician assistant's performance in the practice, knowledge, skills, patient care, and health records. It goes to say that physician's assistants aren't operating independently of their physicians. There are checks and balances as far as what they are allowed to do and what they are not allowed to do. Under the active collaborative plan, physicians authorize PA's functions and the medications they can prescribe. So a physician could say, you know what, you can't prescribe these sorts of things simply because I want to limit it. In Alaska, if the physician's assistant has a DEA authorization number, they can prescribe schedule 2 through 5 substances. Would you like me to summarize what those are for the record?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, through the Chair, Schedule 1 drugs are substances or chemicals that are defined as drugs with no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. Some common examples would be heroin, LSD, marijuana is a Schedule 1 drug currently, and peyote. Schedule 2 drugs are drug substances or chemicals that are defined as drugs with a high potential for abuse and with use potentially leading to severe psychological or physical dependence. And Schedule 2 through 5, again, are what PAs are allowed to prescribe under current law. Examples of Schedule 2 drugs being Vicodin, cocaine, methamphetamine, oxycodone, fentanyl, and Ritalin is a commonly prescribed medication. Schedule 3 drugs are substances or chemicals with a moderate to low potential for physical and psychological dependence. A common example would be Tylenol with codeine. Schedule 4 drugs are substances or chemicals with a low potential for abuse and low risk of dependence, such as Xanax, Soma, Darvone, Valium would be another one, Ambien. And Schedule 5 drugs have a lower potential for abuse than Schedule 4 drugs, namely codeine with cough syrup with codeine in it. So anything between the Schedule 2 and the Schedule 5 I read, physician's assistants could hypothetically prescribe with the oversight of their physicians.
Thank you.
Ma'am. The benefits of House Bill 97, if I could turn the committee's attention to, there's two maps in your packet by the Health Resources and Services Administration, federal government entity. The green map outlines the health professional shortage areas. And the map with the taupe colors shows the medically underserved areas and populations. And if you look to where Alaska is, out in the middle of the Pacific, just above American Samoa, you can see that most of the state of Alaska is both a medically underserved area and has a shortage of healthcare professionals. Passage of HB 97, its companion SB 44, would allow over 700 physicians assistants to engage in telehealth services within the state of Alaska. So the numbers are not small. By doing this, this would extend the reach of medicine to patients in underserved areas. And to summarize, if you would excuse me, the State Medical Board has assumed a neutral position on this bill. We do have Deborah Stovern online, I believe, to answer questions if there are specific ones. A fiscal note, there's a $5,300 fiscal note. These are program receipts, so no general fund costs, and it is $0 after that. That initial year basically covers the legal costs of mailing postage and letting people know that this is now available.
Excuse me, who did you say that we had online to answer questions?
Deborah Stovern, I believe, from the State Medical Board.
There's no one online from the state.
It will be short.
Ah, okay.
Oh. I can keep talking to the committee's content if you would like.
Go ahead, Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned 700 physician's assistants. Is that how many are in Alaska, or is that how many are licensed in Alaska? Are some of them remote, out of state, that you can access through telehealth only?
Representative Wall, through the chair, these are people that are in Alaska, as I understand it. Deborah Stovern could give you the more specific number on that, I believe.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, through the chair, Mr. Chair, when the first telemedicine statutes were passed, or when the committees on the House side were considering them, I actually happened to be the staffer who was handling some of those some number of years ago, and there's major concern with outsourcing of medical jobs from the state of Alaska to other places. Namely, we had a couple of telemedicine providers from down south up here essentially wanting this to happen, and there was concern that we would start outsourcing our doctors' jobs to other parts of the United States, and as far as we can tell, that hasn't been a big thing. There are some specialists where people in the state of Alaska aren't able to address issues, in which case the outsourcing could potentially happen.
Thank
you, Madam
Chair. Well, there was a, I don't know if it was in this committee, the teledocs that our insurance uses right now, which is an outside, I forget where they are exactly, but not in Alaska.
Tennessee.
Excuse me?
Tennessee, I believe.
Yeah. So I guess it is happening.
The company is located in Tennessee. I would ask Ms. Stovern to speak to this a little bit more clearly, I think, than I could. But as I understand it, the doctors still reside in the state of Alaska.
You want to direct that question to
Ms. Stovern? Yeah, my understanding was that they were on call 24/7. If you called up this 800 number, you weren't necessarily, in fact, it sounded like you weren't getting a doctor in Alaska, but I guess we can find out for sure.
Ms. Stovern, did you hear the question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Deborah Stovern with the Department of Commerce for the record, and I am I serve as the executive administrator for the State Medical Board. And I'm sorry, was the question how many licensed PAs are in the state versus just generally licensed?
My first question was the 700 PAs that he referenced, are they all in state? And I was told yes. But then my next question was about out-of-state telehealth services provided by companies such as Teladocs, which my understanding was the physicians were not in-state. They were many of them out-of-state, and I didn't know the answer to that.
Thank you. Through the chair, there are approximately 700 physician assistants licensed in the state. We don't have statistics on how many are actually practicing in the state. I could certainly look up how many have in-state addresses versus out-of-state addresses, but that wouldn't necessarily be accurate. It could give you an idea, and I'd be happy to follow up with that information after the hearing. Regarding the physicians who supervise physician assistants, there is a requirement that in order to enter into a collaborative plan between a physician and a physician assistant, that they both must be licensed in Alaska. But again, there's no requirement that either reside in the state of Alaska, and there's no statistics to track exactly who is practicing in the state versus having an in-state or out-of-state address.
Thank you.
You want to continue with your present? I see your hand up, Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, I can't remember Reed's last name.
Harris,
thank you. Mr. Harris, you referenced that the State Medical Board hasn't taken a position on the bill. Can I ask Ms. Stover as to whether that's logistics the board hasn't met, whether they by policy don't take positions on the bill, or can you fill me in as to why the State Medical Board doesn't have a position on it?
Ms. Stovern?
Thank you. Yes, through the chair, the board met in February and reviewed the bill and did take a position in support of the bill, and they did issue a letter referencing that position in support. If it's not been provided, I'm happy to provide that to you.
That would be great.
I have it. I was just going off of verbal testimony. And I guess my question, perhaps Mr. Harris can enlighten us, but when the original statute was written giving doctors authorization, Was it an oversight that physician's assistants weren't included? Because physician assistants always have to be in a relationship with a doctor. And was it just assumed that they would be covered by that and an oversight? Or was there an explicit intent at the time to leave physician assistants out?
Directed at myself. Representative Hannon through the chair. I have a litany of emails between the original people who wrote and carried this bill through committee stating that physicians' assistants, it was assumed that because physicians were allowed to practice telemedicine, the PAs practicing under them would be able to practice telemedicine. It is not irrational that the board said, well, you mentioned physicians but not PAs, because they have to be able to oversee the PA scope of practice as well, including admonish them or punish them if they step outside of that scope of practice. So the reason we have this bill is in order to allow the state medical board to keep control over that specific type of provider.
Okay. Thank you.
Continue.
This bill has an effective date of March 1st, 2020, per request of the State Medical Board, in order to give them time to get the regulations going. And that is all I have for the committee. If there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Do we have any questions? Well, with no questions, I'm going to now open public testimony. And it looks like there is one person online to testify. That would be Christopher Dietrich from Orion Behavioral Health. Mr. Dietrich, are you online? Or is it Dr. Dietrich?
It's PA Dietrich.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Chris Dietrich. I'm a PA working in Alaska. Thank you for your time today. Physician assistants are medical providers who diagnose illness, develop and manage treatment plans, prescribe medications, and often serve as a patient's principal health care provider. With thousands of hours of medical training, physician assistants are versatile and collaborative. Physician assistants practice in every state and every medical setting and specialty, improving health care access and quality. I practice adolescent and child psychiatry throughout Alaska, from Kotzebue to Ketchikan, and also practice in another underserved population demographic with the Department of Corrections. I'm advocating today for the support of HB 97, in particular advocating such to decrease barriers in my patients and rural access. This bill does not change my scope of practice and my ability to treat established patients via telemedicine. This bill makes the initial contact easier for patients to have adequate treatment. This bill eliminates the unnecessary barrier for a face-to-face exam to establish a relationship with patients. One example of how this hinders care is if I have a patient who's discharged from the hospital with medications. They may return to a village, such as St. Michael or Stebbins next door. The delay in inadequate evaluation may then take months before they can be seen in person. If the patient is not able to continue their prescriptions or be adequately monitored, this could have severe concerns, and unfortunately, suicide could be one of those. Thank you guys for your time, for letting me give public testimony today.
Thank you. Is there anyone else either online or in person who would like to testify on this bill? Well, seeing no one, I will now close public testimony. Are there any further questions or comments from the committee? Hearing none, amendments are due no later than May 2nd, 2019 at noon. Thank you very much. Our second item on the agenda today is HB 29, coverage for telehealth. This is our second hearing on HB 27. Doesn't look like Representative Sponholz is here yet, but her staff, Bernice Nesbitt. Why don't we take a brief at ease? I understand that Representative Sponholz is on her way. Again, this is our second hearing on HB 29, and Representative Sponholz is now here with her staff, Bernice Nesbitt. So do we have any questions from the committee for either Representative Sponholz or for Bernice? Do you want to join us up there at the table?
Hello.
And, today is the day that we have set for public testimony, and it is my understanding that we have online for testimony and available for any questions the committee members may have the following: Vicki Knapp, Program Coordinator with Matsu Health Network, Chris Dietrich, PA, Assistant Medical Director with Orion Behavioral, Wade Erickson, MD with Capstone Express, Dr. Lynn Freeman, Psychologist with Mind Matter, LLC, and Claudia Tucker, National Consultant with Teladoc. So unless you'd like to make any statements before we get into public testimony, I'm going to open it for public testimony right now. So why don't we begin with Mr. Dietrich. Mr. Dietrich, are you on the line?
Yep, I'm still here. So this is Chris Dietrich again. Just advocating again for support for a different bill, Navigating Day for Support of HB 29. HB 29 now, if the patients have both private insurance and Medicaid, if they receive telehealth services and the private insurance denies it, then the cost of services is shifted over to the state. So that's one of the things that I think hasn't been looked at for savings for the state, is that actually if this goes through, basically allowing telehealth parity amongst insurances, that it will actually reduce, it will have some fiscal changes, cost savings to the state. I think that hadn't been maybe talked about in the previous committees when I've talked before. I'm definitely advocating for it. You know, if we have patients that only have one insurance and that one insurance does not include telehealth coverage, it significantly hinders their care. Thank you guys again for letting me give public testimony for this today.
Thank you. Next online is Robin, is it Menard, with the Matsu Health Foundation? Thank you. Next online is Claudia Tucker with Teladoc Health. Ms. Tucker?
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you. Claudia Tucker, I'm Vice President of Government Affairs for Teladoc Health. Appreciate the opportunity to comment. We stand in support of House Bill 29. It does a lot of things right. It requires coverage parity while not requiring reimbursement parity. Which, as the other gentleman said, you know, it will mandate coverage, but it does not get into the contractual relationship for reimbursement between the provider and the health plan. The fact that it does not require a prior in-person is good policy, and we support it. We have a strong relationship in Alaska. In 2018, Teladoc Health saved the citizens and the state of Alaska $3.5 million through the use of telemedicine, telehealth. We've got 47 Alaska licensed physicians working in Alaska, and we cover about 50,000 lives in the state. Glad to answer any questions.
Representative Wong.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Tucker, the subject of Teladocs came up, and are the physicians that work for, if I call Teladocs in the middle of the night, I understand the physician's license in Alaska. Are they in Alaska, or are they outside in another state?
They could be either. First requirement, they must be licensed in Alaska. We give preference to an Alaska resident physician when a call comes in. So currently, if you look at call volume in 2018, approximately 30% of those calls were answered by a physician who actually lives in Alaska. However, all of them are answered by physicians who are licensed in Alaska. The other part is they actually live there in the state or residents.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Tucker? And I understand Robin Menard. Thank you very much, Ms. Tucker. I understand that Robin Menard is back online.
I am. Thank you so much. This is Robin Menard. I'm the Chief Communications Officer at the Matsu Health Foundation in Wasilla. Representatives Ledoux and Wool and members of the committee, thanks so much for the opportunity to testify. The Matsu Health Foundation shares ownership in Matsu Regional Medical Center and invests our share of the profits back into the community to improve the health and wellness of Alaskans living in Matsu. And we are calling today to testify fully in support of House Bill 29. This bill addresses and solves two health-related problems faced by Matsu residents and really all Alaskans. and those are transportation and access to care. And as background, every 3 years, the foundation conducts a community health needs assessment. The two most recent assessments, which were conducted with our community partners in 2016 and 2013, included extensive data analysis, public polling, and community forums. Transportation was identified as the number one factor affecting health in our community in the 2016 study, and access to care was identified as a top health issue in the 2013 study. Requiring insurers to offer coverage for services provided via telemedicine addresses both transportation and access. Traditional health care provided in a physician's office or other medical facility requires reliable, affordable transportation. Telemedicine eliminates this barrier. It allows for easier access to care, not only for people who don't have transportation, but also for individuals experiencing limited mobility, those who are perhaps caregivers to young children, and older Alaskans who find it difficult to get out of the house. Today, patients postpone preventative care, medication refills, and early intervention due to access, costs, weather, and even lack of time. This ultimately increases overall health care costs when people wait to treat problems until they're a crisis and end up in the emergency department, which is the most expensive place to receive care. While many patients in rural areas, including the more rural parts of MatSU, can benefit from telemedicine, this is not just a rural issue. Patients who struggle with medical conditions that make it difficult, uncomfortable, or exhausting to see a provider in person for treatment can benefit no matter where in Alaska they live. As of 2016, 32 states had passed parity laws requiring insurers to pay for insurance, or excuse me, for services via telemedicine. And we hope that, our legislature does the same. Thank you for considering this important bill to give access to quality health care to more Alaskans. And by the way, we also support HB 97, although this testimony was focused on HB 29.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next online is Lynn Freeman, and incidentally, Representative Fionce has just joined us. Ms. Freeman.
Yes, thank you. I am Lynn Freeman with Mind Matters Research. And historically, what I have done is actually perform clinical research with patients using various counseling and mind-body integrative techniques and comparing them both delivered in person as opposed to by telemedicine or telehealth. And in my studies, which pretty much compare with what findings are in many of my colleagues' studies, the outcomes were almost identical, meaning that you can receive the same quality of care by doing telehealth as you can by having someone come to your office. I would even argue that in many cases, you will have much better care and get better outcomes by using telehealth. Some examples I can give you are chronic pain patients that I treat who find that driving to and from an office puts them in tremendous discomfort and makes it difficult for them to concentrate when they get into session. I also have many patients who are on very limited income. Driving to and from or arranging for travel to and from is both stressful and sometimes undoable for them, even when their insurance would cover them to receive care in an office. I pretty much specialize in chronic pain patients, but mostly my patients have chronic diseases of various types, and they're referred to me by various physicians across the state. Many don't get to Anchorage very often, so perhaps what we will do is arrange for them to see me in person when they can, when they may be in for other physicians' appointments, but this does not prevent them from getting good ongoing and consistent care when they are not in town, whether they're from Barrow or Valdez or wherever they are. So I would really like to tell you how much I strongly support House Bill 29. I think it is absolutely critical for the well-being of our patients in Alaska. And the research I did with NIH around this issue was designed specifically to assure that telehealth would be a part of interventions so that we could assure that no one was left out. Thank you for your time, and I strongly support HB 29.
Thank you. Next online is Wade Erickson. Dr. Erickson,
yes.
You want to identify yourself, and then you can proceed?
Yes. My name is Wade Erickson, and I'm a family physician in Wasilla, Alaska. I'm calling in support of HB 29. I've been doing telemedicine now for the last 6 years, and as a family physician, there's many of my patients are located in rural areas, and so it's a natural fit for that type of relationship. However, I use it for local folks as well. There's frequently times when busy moms have questions about their children that it would be more prudent to handle it through a video conference or a telephone call than through an appointment, especially in the after hours, evening time frame. So we see a significant improvement in patient care, access for care, and then a reduction in the use of both urgent care and emergency room services through proper use of telemedicine.
Thank you. So is there anyone else, either online or in person, that would like to testify about this bill? Seeing and hearing no one, I'll now close public testimony. Are there any further questions from the committee? Is there any committee discussion or comments? All right, what's the will of the committee?
Chairwoman Ledoux, I move HB 29 Insurance Coverage for Telehealth, version 31-LS0274-A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Hearing no objection, that bill, version 31-LS0274-A, moves from the Labor and Commerce Committee, and we are going to have a brief at ease to sign the bill folder. Next up, last item on the agenda today is HB 104, Mortgage Loan Originator Licensing. This is our second hearing on House Bill 104. Amendments were due no later than Monday, April 29th at noon. No amendments were received. It is my understanding that Patrice Walsh, Director with Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, Banking, and Securities, is available online for any questions. And we also have Barbara Barnes here, aide to Representative Tammy Wilson. I will now open public testimony. So to begin with, it looks like we have Stacy Harville from over at the Fairbanks LIO. Ms. Harville, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
You want to identify yourself for the record, and then you can proceed.
I am Stacy Harville. I'm a licensed realtor at Madden Real Estate. Thank you, Madam Chair, as a member of the committee. I have a few comments in support of House Bill 104. I believe this bill provides strong consumer protection for both buyers and sellers. It opens up so many more options for people when it comes to buying and selling in the state of Alaska. There are many situations and properties in Alaska that do not fit the typical traditional financing mold. A few examples are mining claims, agricultural farms, remote cabins, and properties located off the grid. Oftentimes, we see buyers that do not meet traditional financing standards, as well as properties that simply do not meet typical lender fit in the box. The solution to this is often owner financing. However, the current law has made it so that a private individual cannot do so unless the dwelling serves as the individual's residence. Most often, we are working with sellers that have relocated or simply do not reside in the property, thus making owner financing illegal under the current law. I believe that House Bill 104 helps adequately address owner financing, and by doing so, is again making it possible for private individuals to sell their properties in many common circumstances. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Representative Wall, do you have a question for Ms. Harville?
I do.
Go right ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Harville, you mentioned private individuals selling types of structures that they don't necessarily live in. This bill has been amended to or changed to add nonprofits. Was that your understanding of the bill initially, other than private individuals, that sort of nonprofit corporations or what are they could also sell in properties?
Yes, through the chair, when we initially, I helped participate in drafting this bill, the nonprofits were not on our radar, but I have seen the additions with them and the what that addition is focusing on absolutely makes sense to me. Those organizations are often very, very small. They might have one person in the whole office who does the originating and all of the underwriting side of stuff. So if that one person happens to leave the office, now they're left without anyone with a mortgage license to be able to fulfill those loans. So I am in support of that piece of it as well.
Thank you. Do you have follow-up? A follow-up?
Yeah, I guess I'm and we'll hear more testimony. So I'm not exactly familiar with all these, what types of nonprofits do this, but the ones you're referring are small sort of mom and pop type operations of one person. So if it was a bigger organization with big staff, a national group, you may feel differently?
Possibly, but not necessarily. I listened in on the hearing that they did on Friday, and they named off the organizations that would be affected, and all of those absolutely made sense to me.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Harville. Next up is Nadine Winters from Fairbanks Neighborhood Housing Services. Nadine, are you on the line?
I am.
Do you want to proceed?
Yes. I'm Nadine Winters. I'm the Executive Director of Fairbanks Neighborhood Housing Services in Fairbanks. And I'm basically testifying in support of HB 104. That nonprofit exemption would very specifically apply to us. We're not a commercial entity. We only offer loan products that aren't available from other lenders. And basically, federal law would exempt an organization like us, except the Alaska law currently is more strict. I think federal law was amended in 2010 to allow for circumstances like us. Fairbanks Neighborhood Housing does only second mortgages, and we only do products that are below market rates. For instance, last year we had more than one employee, but we have five employees, and we are a mission-driven organization. We receive funding from organizations that comply with our mission. For example, we have two programs. They're closing costs and down payment assistance. One of them is at 0% interest, and it's for people whose income does not exceed 80% of area median income. So it's a very specific targeted. We have another program that does closing costs and down payment assistance for first-time home buyers, and it also has income criteria, so income can't exceed 120% of area median income. So what we offer are products that aren't available by traditional lenders. I've certainly heard the competition discussion or argument. We're not really competing with primary lenders. In fact, they're going to end up with more mortgages because with the products we offer, we're going to get more first-time home buyers into homes. And so for that reason, we support it. It's not for anyone who shows up. It's basically for people who, organizations like ours who it fulfills our mission, and the sources of the funding that we receive are very clear about who and how that money can be dispersed. And so for that reason, I would say we're not competing with anyone, and we would certainly welcome this. The prior testimony was correct in that I'm a licensed mortgage loan originator, but if I have to go have surgery while I'm gone, we literally cannot give someone terms on a loan, even if our loans are at 0%. We can't say that's how stringent it is now. And so this would be a blessing for us just simply because we can get more low and moderate income first-time home buyers into homes. And thank you for your time.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Winters, I was going to ask if anyone at your entity was a licensed registered loan originator, and you are. So my second question would be, what kind of screening do you do for the employees you have to make sure that they can't abuse the financial information they would have about an individual applying for a loan?
So basically, since we are currently regulated, basically we have confidentiality policies. We have mortgage underwriting, even though they're second mortgages, policies and procedures. And then also our funding sources basically require a whole litany of those assurances as well. So basically, like for instance, for like the HOT program, for the 80% program, basically we package those loans, we work with the first lender, and then we actually have to get HFC to approve those before we actually do the loans on those. So that was probably a long answer, but basically policies and procedures, confidentiality agreements, and Fair Housing Act, and all the other training that goes along with RESPA and all the other laws.
Follow up. One specific, just to make sure I have it on the record. And I assume that includes a criminal background check on each?
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
All right.
Criminal background and credit as well.
Thank you. Representative Wall.
Thank you. Nadine, you say you're a licensed loan originator. So mm-hmm. does that mean mm-hmm. you handle all the loans in your office?
Basically, yes. I basically do terms, and then I have a loan processor that does the voluminous paperwork requirements. Yes.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
And you say you offer products that aren't offered by banks. What if a nonprofit isn't like you and offers products that are offered by banks?
Then they don't meet the definition of commercial, and this exemption wouldn't apply to them. So it wouldn't apply to them. So if someone is basically doing the same thing as a bank, they don't meet this definition, and this exemption wouldn't apply to them. They would be regulated just like everybody else. This is my understanding is that there's literally, I think, four agencies in the state currently that this would impact, and it's us and the Habitat organizations.
Okay. Follow up.
Go ahead.
So I guess I'm a little confused on that. And so if they sold a product that the bank sells, then by definition, they'd be a commercial lender, and then they wouldn't apply for it. They couldn't be a nonprofit group that offers a loan that a bank may offer the same product.
Right, but this exemption is structured so that it wouldn't apply to them. So you can be a nonprofit. I think one of the examples is NeighborWorks Alaska in Anchorage. They do first mortgages, they do second mortgages, but the fact that they have that commercial product as well as products similar to what we offer, this exemption doesn't apply to them. It's not any nonprofit that shows up. It has to meet that definition.
Okay. Follow up, I guess.
Go ahead.
So the 0% loan, which seems pretty low, and mm-hmm. if I was in the banking industry, I'd say, wow, that's undercutting my rate. But you're saying they don't even offer that kind of loan. And are these for certain kinds of properties? Or these are people that wouldn't qualify.
Right. So, for instance, for the HOP loan, it's not undercutting them, because what we're doing is that what we do is that we basically tag on to a first mortgage. So in the case of the 0% program, there's your income can't exceed 80% of area median income. The value of the home can't exceed $219,000. That's set by HUD. And what happens is that people go to get a first mortgage and they don't have enough money for closing costs and down payment assistance. The first lender refers them to us. And if they meet our program criteria, which is very specific about ratios, then we offer them the closing costs and down payment assistance. So the primary lender gets a mortgage that they wouldn't have had without our product helping their loan client. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I follow up. So basically, your down payment and such helps them to get a bank loan to buy the house.
Yes,
you're just
exactly.
It's a two-part deal. You're helping them out with the cash they need up.
Exactly. Yeah, and all of our programs are for first-time home buyers, and so and that's definition of HF. Yeah, so we're doing that, and we're doing it for first-time home buyers. And so we've done – so all of – every second mortgage that we do is tied to a first lender that wouldn't – their client would not have been able to get into that home without our program assistance.
Okay, thank you. I'm done. Yeah,
you're
thanks.
Done. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for being here, Ms. Winters. You may not have any idea, but I was just wondering, you talked about the four organizations. What actual percentage share are you of the home market? Would you know offhand?
I'm sorry. I don't know. I mean, we don't. So, for instance, I would say I don't know what the total market is per se, but I do know that I think we've done loans with every, you know, lender in Fairbanks. But we're talking volume. So, for instance, the HOP money that we got last year, I think we got $340,000, and I think we did 13 second mortgages. So we have 13 new home buyers. So that's what we're talking about in volume. The other money that we have is for closing costs and down payment assistance, that is, it goes up to 120% of area median income people. We have, that might be 30 loans maybe over the course of a year. So that's what we're talking for our volume. I just don't know what, as a percentage, that would be of the total.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I guess
go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Winters, you said if someone's getting a second mortgage, so if someone owns a house and they want to get a second mortgage on it, are they required to come up with a down payment if they've already been paying for the loan on their house? I guess that's what you help them out with. So is that pretty standard? They'd have to come up with another down payment?
If they already have a mortgage, we're not helping them out. This is getting new first-time home buyers into homes. And so if people want a second mortgage on top of their original mortgage, that's not going to be a client of ours, because AARs are income eligible, and in one case, there's a cap on the value of the home. And so it's more if someone goes to a say they have a realtor and they go to a bank and they said, okay, we want this house and we can afford it, but they don't have enough for closing costs and down payment, then they would come to us. So if they have an existing mortgage, they're not going to be one of the clients that we serve.
Okay, I follow.
Go ahead.
I thought I misunderstood earlier that you said a second mortgage. So really, you're not originating a mortgage. You're just helping them out with some fees, right? I mean, the bank's doing the mortgage. They should want you to be helping them, right?
Personally, that's what I think. Yes. So we're helping them with the fees. Yeah, because they wouldn't. We're helping people that with traditional loan product by itself would not be able or be able to afford getting into a home. So yeah, we're like the supplement. Now, you know, even though we're at 0%, you know, like for instance, one of them is you can get up to $30,000 to help you get into this home. If you stay owner-occupied for 5 years, the first $10,000 is forgiven, and then you basically have the remainder at 0% that you don't have to do anything until you sell or refinance. So yeah, we're augmenting, I think, a certain population of home buyer in the community and not really competing at all.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Winters. Next on the line is Patrick Anderson from Rural Community Action Program. Mr. Anderson,
good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Please identify yourself.
My name, but I'll introduce myself again. I'm Patrick Anderson. I serve as the Chief Executive Officer of the Rural Alaska Community Action Program. So we have been discussed. We're a 501c3 nonprofit agency operating in Alaska, and we are a licensed mortgage loan originator as required by state law. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 104 as amended to exempt nonprofit organizations such as RuralCAP from the requirements. We basically operate a home ownership line of business where we close second mortgages for low-income home buyers that are serviced and funded by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. In the past 7 years, we've closed only 36 such loans while expending in excess of $20,000 in fees to maintain compliance. In addition, I'm a part of the extensive staff and board time required to maintain compliance with the regulations. I've gone through a couple of trainings, as has my CFO and chief operating officer, as well as numerous other staff. These both time and money resources are diverted from serving low-income people in the state of Alaska. So we are fully in support of the exemption. It would apply to those programs like us that operate in areas where the individuals we serve would not be able to purchase a home. In fact, our programs are the mutual self-help ownership program, where the purchasers of the home are guided by our staff as they build their own home, and for which they need financing in the interim to support much of the purchases that they have to make in order to buy the land and the improvements on it. So, now, like I said, we're fully in support of it. We certainly appreciate those who propose this amendment. It would provide a benefit to those small number of people who actually partake in our mutual self-help housing programs. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Anybody have any questions for Mr. Anderson? Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Anderson, we've now heard the term second mortgage used by two different entities, and I don't know if you heard Ms. Winters from the Fairbanks Neighborhood Housing Association describe the circumstance in which she was using it. To most of us who aren't in the industry, when you say second mortgage, we think a second property. So could you either define for me or give me additional examples of what second mortgage means for your industry and your licensure and the mortgages you're hosting?
Well, basically, as I understand our program, we use the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. We end up buying the property, and if we finance it, it's the first mortgage. Then we subdivide it for anywhere from like 6 to 15 different families to purchase. So it's already subject to a first mortgage until they complete their project, and then we would sever it. So my understanding is the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation provides that funding for the families that we serve. And you've already heard a couple of really good explanations about income eligibility. We also have income eligibility for the properties that we serve, and we currently have just two that are in the Kenai-Soldotna area. And we have plans in place for a third that go into the Nome area. Those, as you well know, are all very expensive places to create affordable housing. So that's my understanding of how we're engaged in it, is that we have the primary mortgage on the property, and then to finance their improvements, we help the families apply for the loan through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Representative Wong.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you buy the property, do you use a bank, or do you just buy it?
We have just bought it. There are also federal programs that we can use to buy it. So I know that we just purchased the property, and we used our cash for it. But it's still, we go through Alaska Housing Finance to finance the builder's portion of it, the independent homeowner that's building the home.
Hello.
Go ahead.
So you said you buy a property and then subdivide between 6 and 15 families. I'm trying to understand what kind of is it. What, maybe I heard you wrong. I don't understand what kind of property this is.
Yeah. Yes, Madam Chair. We will buy a larger piece of property and then have it subdivided. The program, Mutual Self-Help, really wouldn't work if we had just one individual family building a home. The resources required are pretty substantial. So we have 6, 7, 8 up to 15 homeowners who are buying into a subdivision and working on a property under our supervision. They do not have to be contractors, but they do have to be willing to work to put up a substantial portion of their own home. So that's why I said it's a mutual self-help program with a number of participants in any one property. Otherwise, the cost would be pretty excessive still.
follow up. Yeah. I get it. You're buying land. I thought it was some kind of condo or a building or something. So you're buying the land. It gets subdivided, and then they build houses on this subdivided land.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
We have any more questions for Mr. Anderson? All right. That about does it for the people that I see online, although we have Patrice Walsh from the Division of Banking and Securities not here to actually testify, but is there anybody who would like to ask Ms. Walsh any questions, particularly about the nonprofit aspect of things? Representative Wong.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, we heard from the banking industry that they're not supportive of the nonprofit aspect of the bill. We've heard from nonprofits saying that they don't really compete with banks, and these aren't loans that banks would necessarily be doing anyways, or they work in conjunction with banks. So what's the banking, what's your response as the Division of Banking person here?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, this is Patrice Walsh. I'm the director for the Division of Banking and Securities. The amount of loans are, as it was asked earlier, the volume for these nonprofits is very minuscule. There's, when you look at, I don't have the exact figure, but it is a very, very low percentage of the volume that these few nonprofits do in compares to of the actual state licensed and also the federally chartered loan originators. So it's definitely falls into the basically public assistance is the way I look at the nonprofits. They are going and offering services to a group that isn't really serviced by the state licensed or federally licensed loan originators. As you heard also, the federal law allows for this exemption, and a lot of other states have adopted that. So Alaska is an outlier there. We still require it because our law has not been converted to keep up with the federal law in this area.
I'm going to let Representative Wall continue with his follow-up, and then Representative Fields, and then Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if this law were changed so that nonprofits could originate loans without being licensed, would that increase the number of loans? Would that make them more prevalent? I mean, you said it's a very minuscule number. And I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were the division. I mean, I did, but you're not in the banking industry. You're in the you work for the state, is that correct?
That is correct,
okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, so I guess my question is, if this restriction were lifted, would there be more loans, and hence it may not be so minuscule?
Mr. Chairman, I do not believe that there would be more loans. The way these nonprofits get their money is through grants. And if there is a small, you know, limited amount of funds that they can get their money from. So we have never, you know, seen the volume increase for these few licensees that we have. Their growth, you know, was very flat.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And of the states, you said federally it's allowable, but Alaska has a restriction. Do you know what the breakdown is with the other states, the other 49 states?
Mr. Chairman, no, I do not. I could try to find that out for you and get back to you with that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Fields.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Putting a number on minuscule, my understanding is something like 13 out of 739 loans in Fairbanks were done by the nonprofits. Do you have numbers in Anchorage?
Mr. Chair, or through the chair, no, I do not have that right now. We would have to do a little work on our end with the data. Licensees do this mortgage call report, and they submit that on a quarterly basis. However, it is not compiled, you know, to where all the licensees show the same, you know, compiled aggregate data. So it would take us just a little bit to try to get that data, but we could do our best to try to give you some percentages.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair. Ms. Walsh, we have a letter from the Alaska Bankers Association expressing their concern about the nonprofit exemption, and it speaks to the federal requirement under Dodd-Frank, the SAFE Act, the Secure and Fair Enforcement of Mortgage Licensing Act, being the crux of their concern, that if we allow non-licensed loan origination, that consumers are at risk. Now, in general, I think of bankers and bank overseers being a fairly conservative and risk-adverse group. So I'm asking you whether you view this as opening a risk to consumers in Alaska if we allow the nonprofit origination of residential mortgage loans.
Representative Hannon, through the chair. No, I do not. The reason is because this exemption, you have to qualify for it. And in that qualification process, there will be an extensive review of the nonprofit. They have to would have to show that they still have, as Ms. Winters mentioned, they still have to have training for their loan originators. They still have to show their policies and procedures and that they're following the federal laws. So we would be in the middle of that still, because they would have to apply for this exemption and have it be renewed. It's just not a one-time thing where they'd get a free ride forever. So they would annually be, you know, have to reapply for this exemption, and we would be looking at those things to make sure that consumer protection is the same as what it is right now.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Ms. Walsh? Well, thank you very much. So that looks like it finishes up those people who are online. Is there anyone else, either online or in person, who would like to testify? Well, in that case, I am going to close public testimony. Are there any further questions from the committee? Is there any committee discussion or comment? Well, then let's take a brief at ease.
I was going to comment back.
Oh. So what is the will of the committee?
May I have a comment?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And as I said earlier, I wasn't here Friday, so I wasn't here during the introduction of the CS. It seems the nonprofits have a limited scope of a limited clientele. It would have been nice to have heard from the banking industry other than this letter, but we didn't, so I don't really, besides the letter, I don't know their objection. So I'm at the will of the committee as well. So.
Well, would you like to make a motion?
I'll make a motion. I move CSHB 104 Mortgage Loan Originating Licensing version 31-LS0275/7/S from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
So hearing no objection, version 31-LS0275/S moves from the Labor and Commerce Committee. And it is now 4:29, and this concludes our meeting for the day. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, May 1st at 3:15. Please stay around to sign the bell folder, and we now stand adjourned.
I couldn't catch it.